Well, it's sweater weather again in April. But we still have, we still have a chance for snow all the way up till Mother's Day, right? It's Indiana. This is our children's moment. We don't have a lot of children here this morning, which is odd, but I'll still do a little something. If you are a guest, we do usually have a place in the back for students and kids during the service. This morning, I brought an apple. An apple, this one's a little bit bruised. It was the last one in the bag. They don't usually last too long to get bruised in my family, but sometimes they escape notice and they'll sit on the counter for a little bit. But this morning I brought an apple, and an apple, if you think about it, we eat these and that kind of thing, but in order to get an apple tree, you have to put this in the ground. And this illustration actually comes straight from Jesus this morning. When he talks about in order for this to be useful, it has to die. We put it in the ground and it dies, and then it produces more fruit, right? A whole lot more fruit. And farmers know this. They know they have to keep back part of their seed, but they only have to keep a little bit, because that little bit goes in the ground and then it spreads. And it makes way more than just the little seed that it went into. And Jesus was talking about himself, and he was talking about us. When he was talking about the seed having to go into the ground and dying, and then growing and producing way more, he was talking about himself. That he was going to be killed and buried in order to produce more. And he also said that if we want a life, we have to lose this life. That we too have to be buried with him. That we have to die with him in order to have life. And it's hard to conceive that, to think about that, to think about having to give up our life, because we think, oh, we've got it under control. But we don't, right? So it's hard to think that we do need to let go. We do need to let go and be buried with him in order to produce more. And I'm going to turn it over to Fred as I go back to see if there's any kids already back there.
Thank you, brother. Good morning. Good to see everybody. If you have your Bibles with you, I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 26, if you will, please. We appreciate my grit for filling in for Don Martyr today. Let's praise God for him. Appreciate that, Don. Don and his family are actually on a boys' retreat, and so that's where they are this morning. Matthew 26, we're going to begin with verse 36 in just a few moments here. My hour has not yet come. Jesus said that several times prior to his crucifixion. But now the hour has come. The hour that Jesus knew was coming ever since he fully understood his mission. The hour that he would often speak about openly, but he dreaded inwardly. The hour that he try to prepare his disciples for, the hour where his friends will leave him, his father will forsake him, and his mother will cry for him. The hour when he will hang upon that old rugged cross on the hill called Golgotha, the place of the skull. And can you imagine how difficult those last hours of Jesus must have been? Everything had been put in place for the night on which Jesus was betrayed. A woodsman commissioned by the Roman government had been working to hewn three crosses from an old tree. The three men are scheduled to die the very next day. And it's not yet known, but one of them will be released and Jesus will die in his place. Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, is in town, not knowing that he would be playing a role in the death of the Son of God, even though he wants no part of it. He wants no part of it. The smell of unleavened bread baking in stone ovens fills the air. The faint cries of lambs being slaughtered can be heard in the distance. A multitude of people have gathered in the city of Jerusalem. And all this in preparation for the feast of the Passover. Now, Jesus had been down. The disciples do not really understand what's going on with their Lord. You know, he's down. This was supposed to be a happy time. I mean, Passover was a great celebration for the Jews, but Jesus, he's just not in a party mood. At supper, he reveals to his disciples that one of them, sitting among them, is going to betray him. And he can't imagine. In fact, they can't imagine who would possibly, in this group, who would do something like that. Jesus also talks about his body being broken and his blood being shed. And still his disciples cannot, comprehend what Jesus is really talking about. It's not that Jesus hadn't spoken plainly to them. They're about his crucifixion. The people, they just not want to hear it. Okay? They don't want to hear it. Prior to supper, Judas had gone to the chief priests and collected 30 pieces of silver to hand Jesus over for them for trial. 30 pieces of silver. As you read the Old Testament, a dead slave was worth 30 pieces of silver. Judas now gets up in the middle of supper to go round up the soldiers, the chief priests, the Pharisees, to arrest his Lord. And it's only a matter of time until Jesus will be hanging on the cross. Now today what I want to do, I want us to walk through Matthew's account of Jesus' last hours from the Garden of Gethsemane to Golgotha, also known as Calvary's Hill, where Jesus is crucified. And what I'm going to be doing this morning, I'm just actually going to be paraphrasing the passages from Matthew, so just kind of follow along with me. Number one, as you're taking notes, Jesus is grieved. Jesus is grieved. Matthew 26, verses 36 through 45. Again, Jesus comes to the Garden of Gethsemane, with his closest friends, Peter, James, and John, to pray. And agonizing over his execution, impending execution, he tells his friends in verse 38, he says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and watch over me. Watch with me. Jesus, again, is deeply, deeply depressed. Betrayal, sorrow, pain, and humiliation await him. I mean, he knows at this very moment that Judas is on his way with a mob of soldiers that take him by force to Caiaphas the high priest to be trialed among the Sanhedrin court. He desperately needs this quiet time with his father. Walking a short distance into the garden, Jesus falls face down to the ground and he begins this heartfelt request recorded in verse 39. He says, my father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. If it is possible... I mean, how many times had Jesus told his disciples that everything is possible with God? Everything. In fact, in Mark's account of this very thing here, Mark affirms what Jesus says. He says, Father, in Mark 14, 36, Father, everything is possible for you. Everything's possible. And what Jesus is saying is, Father, if there is any other way, don't let me go through this horrible ordeal. If there's any other way that the world can be saved, don't let it be like this. And he knows, again, that everything is possible for God, and if God willed it, he wouldn't have to be crucified. And yet Jesus says, Father, it's not what I want, but it's what you want that matters. And as if it wasn't enough to agonize over his destiny in prayer, he now comes back and he finds his friends asleep. They're all asleep. I mean, I can just hear the hurt in Jesus' voice when he asks in verse 40. He says, couldn't you stay awake and watch out for me for just 1 hour? Just 1 hour? I mean, there are these, you know, here is his dearest, deepest, closest friends in the world. And Jesus had always been there for them in their times of distress, in their times of trouble. He's always been there. And when he needs the most, they're just not around. They're just not there for him. Now somehow, when we talk about Jesus grieving in the garden, that is foreign to some people. It's hard to picture Jesus, you know, agonizing and grieving over his death. However, the cross to Jesus was much more than simply an instrument of death, okay? I mean, he knew that he was going to live again. You know, he told his disciples many times, I'm going to be turned over to these ruthless men. They're going to kill me. 3 days later, I'm going to rise from the dead. He knew he was going to live again, but I believe that what had prompted this agonizing prayer in the garden was that this horrific ordeal that he was going to be facing. And although he was the Son of God, Jesus was also 100% human, who experienced the same pain and suffering, frustrations and emotions as we. And yet, even though the physical and emotional suffering would be unbearable, what I believe, what Jesus despised the most, according to Hebrews 12, verse 2, is the shame of the cross. The shame of the cross. I mean, he was rejected as the Son of God and died a common criminal. The sinless died as a sinner. And Jesus knew while hanging on the cross, bearing the sins of the entire world, his Father could have no fellowship with him. And for these reasons, Jesus prays, Father, please don't let me go through this shame. But if you think I must, I will. But then secondly, Jesus is betrayed. He's betrayed. Matthew 26, verses 47 through 56. And again, as Jesus leaves the garden, Judas comes with a band of armed soldiers to take Jesus to the high priest to be trialed. I mean, can you imagine an army with weapons in hand being sent to arrest one lowly preacher? I mean, Judas knew that Jesus wouldn't hurt anyone, and yet he leads an army into the garden where he knew that Jesus was praying. And he walks casually up to Jesus, and he says in verses 49 through 50, he says, greetings, teacher, and then kisses him. And Jesus replied, friend, do what you came for. Friend? I mean, Jesus calls Judas a friend. I mean, didn't he understand what that kiss was for? Doesn't he know that Judas has just sold him for a few bucks? Doesn't he know that? Oh, yes, he knew all of that. But yet, Jesus loved even his betrayer. He loved Judas deeply. Now, while studying Matthew's account of Judas's betrayal of Jesus, we often overlook a very short sentence that appears in no other gospel but Matthew's. And it's found in the very last sentence of verse 56. Verse 56 of Matthew 26. And it says, then all the disciples deserted him and fled. Now, we know about Judas's betrayal and Peter's denial that we're going to be talking about in just a moment here. But what about the desertion of the other 10? Now John, you know, the disciple whom Jesus loved, will come back later. But at this moment, he too, along with all the rest, are running like scared rabbits. I would have said jackrabbits, but most of you have never seen one, okay? But can you imagine how difficult it must have been for Matthew to write these words? Then all the disciples deserted him and left. I mean, he was one of them. He was one of them. And undoubtedly, all as he's writing those words, all the emotions that he felt that night resurfaced. You know, he probably put down his pen and just wept. I remember when I deserted my Lord. Remember how he also ran, just like with all the others, when Jesus needed his friends most. He and all the other disciples that Jesus had loved on and been with for 3 years, they all left him. And where do you think the disciples went that night after they fled? What do you think? You ever think about that? Where did they go? Now we know that Peter, you know, followed the soldiers at a distance as they took Jesus to the court of the high priest, Matthew 26, verse 58. John winds up at the foot of the cross, John 19, verse 26. But how about all the rest? I mean, Judas, we know, of course, you know, he betrayed Jesus. Later on, he's going to hang himself. But where were the others when the sky became darkened? Were they near the temple when the curtain ripped? Were they near the cemetery when the graves opened? Did they even dare sneak back to the hillside and stand at the edge of the crowd and stare at the three crosses on the hill? The tears well up in their eyes when they heard Jesus in agony cry from that cross, "Father, forgive them, for they don't even know what they're doing." But then thirdly, Jesus is tried. He is tried. Matthew 26, verses 57 through 68. I mean, talk about a kangaroo court. I mean, this is it, okay? This is it. The justices are not looking for the truth. They're not out there, you know, to set an innocent man free. They are out there to hang Jesus. In fact, I want you to listen to what it says here, Matthew 26, verses 59 through 61. Listen to these words. As Jesus is being tried by the Sanhedrin, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. I mean, that's their aim. They want to put Jesus to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" I mean, they can't find any evidence against Jesus, although there were, you know, many false witnesses, you know, eager to testify against him. And so what they do is they take the words that Jesus meant spiritually, referring to his physical body being killed and then raised again in 3 days, and they make Jesus sound like a madman out to destroy the temple of God that took years to build, and then he's just going to rebuild it in 3 days. You know, this is a crazy madman. But yet, Jesus does not give an answer, you know, to the charges against him that he's a blasphemer. But then finally, that high priest, in verses 63 through 64, you know, made Jesus swear on the name of God if he was the Christ. "Are you the Christ?" And Jesus replied emphatically, "Yes, it is as you say. I am the Christ." Now, Caiaphas, the high priest, I mean, he had the evidence he needed. I mean, he has now, this madman has now admitted that he's the Messiah, that he's the Son of God. This itinerant preacher, this lowly carpenter, this blasphemer claims to be Christ, the Son of God. And so Caiaphas asked the council, in verse 66, he said, "What do you think? What shall we do with him?" And the people cry out, "He's worthy of death. He's worthy of death." And then the physical abuse and torture began. Jesus stood helplessly with his hands bound behind him as the mob of people began to mock and spit upon him. Unsuspectingly, someone hits him from behind. It's one of the guards. Jesus falls to the ground, and the guard stands him on his feet again and then punches him in the stomach. A voice from the crowd cries out, "He says he's the Christ, so see if he can prophesy. See if he can prophesy." So another guard takes a kerchief and roughly blindfolds Jesus, and then someone starts beating Jesus about the face of his fist. Another slaps him, "Prophesy to us, Christ, prophesy. Who hit you? Who hit you?" Roaring laughter can be heard from the crowd as Jesus is struck with one blow after another. Again, you talk about an unfair trial. The guilty verdict was pronounced before Jesus walked into that courtroom. Now the task before the Sanhedrin was, okay, now what we got to do now? We're going to have to convince Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, to have Jesus crucified. And as Jesus is taken to Pilate, you know, he is led past Peter, who is standing outside in the courtyard. Brings us to number 4. Jesus is disowned. Jesus is disowned. Matthew 26, 69 through 75. You know, I think as painful as it must have been to take blows from the fists of your enemies, the words Jesus is about to hear from the mouth of Peter just pierced his heart and his soul. "I don't know what you're talking about," Peter said when he was asked if he was with Jesus. And it's interesting to note that the first two people who confronted Peter were girls. One of them was a servant girl, verses 69 and 71. This servant girl and then another girl approaches Jesus and says, "You're one of them." This is not a soldier who puts a sword to the heart of Jesus and said, you know, the heart of Peter and say, "You know, you're one of the blasphemer's followers, aren't you? You follow him too, right?" These were two girls who posed no threat. And yet Peter says, "I don't even know who you're talking about. I don't know this man. I don't know him." And then there's a third time. Some came to Peter and said, verse 73, surely you're one of them because your accent gives you away. And I can picture Peter trying to disguise his Galilean accent as he begins to curse, you blankety blank. "I told you that I don't know this man. I don't know him." And then Peter hears a haunting sound in the night. A rooster crows. It all comes flooding back because just before Peter told Jesus that he would die for him just hours before, I would give, everybody else might leave you, Lord, but not me. I will die for you. But yet Jesus told him that before the night was over, he would deny him 3 times. Matthew 26, verse 34. But Luke records an event. It's only in Luke's gospel. But he records an event that was even more heart-piercing to Peter than hearing the crow of a rooster. In Luke 22, verse 61, it says this, very simply. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. He turned and he looked straight at Peter. Now, even though Jesus knew it was going to happen, it must have hurt. It must have hurt to actually hear the words come from the mouth of one of his dearest friends. And I can picture Peter looking into the eyes of Jesus and see tears just, you know, rolling down his Lord's bruised and bloody cheeks. Peter's heart must have sank to see Jesus standing there And hearing him say, I don't even know who this man is. And realizing that he had just disowned his Lord, Peter was crushed. He was crushed. And then in verse 75, the latter part of that verse says, he went outside and wept bitterly. Now, he didn't weep because he was caught, okay? That's not why Peter's crying, okay? These weren't tears that said, well, next time I've got to be a little bit smarter about this or a little bit more careful, you know? I mean, these were tears of deep godly sorrow and repentance. Peter denied his Lord three times. It wasn't something that he had planned to do. In fact, again, he said he was willing to die for Jesus. And in verse 51, he proved it by pulling a sword when the guards came to arrest Jesus, pulling a sword, swinging that sword, and cutting off the right ear of Malchus, the chief priest's servant. I mean, Peter was out there to stop Jesus from being arrested. He was willing to die for Jesus. But now, he weeps bitterly, realizing that the unthinkable thing he said that he would never do, he did. And wishing to God that he could just take it back. But he can't. And then finally, Jesus is crucified. Number five, he's crucified. Matthew 27, 11 through 56. Jesus had already been tried and found guilty of blasphemy by the Jewish council. The Roman law forbade the Jews from executing anybody. So they bind Jesus and they take him to Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, to be executed. Are you the king of the Jews? Pilate asked Jesus. Now, I want you to understand that this charge might have been important to the Jews, but it didn't matter to Pilate if Jesus claimed to be the king of the Jews or not. He really didn't care. He looks at him as just simply, being harmless. There's a harmless man standing before him. Okay, he claims to be the king of the Jews. Big deal. What does that mean? But then Jesus affirmed that he was the king of the Jews. That's who I am. But then the chief priests and elders began presenting their accusations against Jesus. And Pilate, not wanting to stir up this problem among the Jews on their the day of the Passover, what he does, he thinks he's got a solution here. So he doesn't, again, want to put Jesus to death, so he presents them with an option. He says, Barabbas or Jesus. It was customary to release a prisoner on this day. And so Pilate, brings Barabbas out there and says, listen, we can just kill Barabbas and let Jesus go. Barabbas or Jesus. Now, Matthew doesn't tell us much about Barabbas beyond the fact that he was a prisoner. But the other gospel writers, however, record that Barabbas was a thief, a murderer, and one who caused riots. He was an insurrectionist. Mark 15:7, Luke 23:19, John 18, verse 40. And I don't know who Barabbas stole from. I have no idea who he murdered or what the riot was about. But this is a man you normally would not want back in your neighborhood. You know what I'm saying? You don't want this guy back on the streets. And although Scripture doesn't say, I personally believe this was the vilest criminal that Pilate had on hand, and he was probably scheduled to be crucified the very next day. So Pilate might have thought that the Jews certainly, if they have a choice between Barabbas and Jesus, they would let Jesus go because they don't want this guy back out on the streets, okay? They don't want him out there. Let Barabbas go, they cried out. Let Barabbas go. I mean, these people were so set on killing Jesus, it didn't matter how wicked and vile Barabbas was. They wanted Jesus gone. They wanted him gone. Pilate then asked the question in verse 22. Okay. What shall I do then with Jesus who is called Christ? And the people cry out, say it with me, crucify him. Crucify him. Kill this man. Kill this man. Pilate had Jesus flogged again and then gave him to the soldiers to be led away to be crucified. But first the soldiers, you know, the Roman soldiers now, it was the temple soldiers before, now it's the Roman soldiers, they're going to have their fun with Jesus too, okay? Verses 27 to 31. So all the soldiers gathered Jesus around Jesus and they began their fun and games. They start off humiliating him by stripping him of his clothing, and Jesus stands before them naked. They grab a scarlet robe and they put around his shoulders. One of the soldiers was already taking a vine of thorns, twisting it together to shape it into a crown to place upon Jesus' head. They put a staff, a broken reed, into his hand. And then they knelt before him, mocking, "Hail, hail the King of Jews." They spit on him and took the reed from his hand, and they began to beat Jesus about the head with it, undoubtedly embedding the crown of thorns deeper and deeper into his skull with each blow. By this time, you can imagine the weakened condition of Jesus. He's been up all night. He has taken several beatings. He's emotionally and physically drained. And then John tells us in John chapter 19, verse 17, that Jesus then is led to the place of the skull, Golgotha, carrying his own cross. However, in his weakened condition, Jesus is unable to carry it very far, and so the soldiers took hold of a man named Simon. Visiting the city during the Passover. Spring up that slide, if you will, please. Visiting the city during the Passover, and they forced Simon to carry Jesus' cross the rest of the way to Golgotha. And as they arrive at Golgotha, they strip Jesus of his clothing once again. And they lay him on the cross, and they begin nailing 6-inch Roman spikes into his hands and into his feet. And they then lift Jesus up, dangling naked on the cross between two thieves. Jesus hung on the cross for an excruciating 6 hours. 6 long hours before he died. But where was God the Father through all this? When his only begotten Son was being tried, tortured, humiliated, and crucified on the cross. Where was God? I mean, did he watch in anger? Did he hear his son cry out to him? Could he have stopped it? Well, next Sunday, we're going to answer those questions. Next Sunday, we will take a deeper look into what the cross tells us about God. The other day we were at a ministry teams leaders meeting. I don't think it was this month. I think it was probably, I don't know if it's February. It might have been February. And I was they asked the question, "What are we doing for Easter? What are you doing for Easter, Fred?" And I said, at that time I really had no idea what I was going to be doing for Easter. I just said, "I bet it's going to be something about the resurrection." You know? It'll be something about the resurrection. And then I think it was Don Ralston who then, you know, jumped in and said, "You did that last year." Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We talked about the resurrection last Easter too. And the Easter before that, the Easter before that, the Easter before that. I mean, we can go on. I've been preaching now for over 40 years, okay? So there's been a lot of Easter Sundays, okay? A lot of Resurrection Sundays since I've been a preacher. But every year we hear this story about what Jesus went through on that cross for us. Every single year. Does hearing about the crucifixion of Jesus still prick your heart? Or is it just old? I've heard that. Yeah. I've already heard that. Well, you know, okay, Jesus, he's going to be crucified, going to die and rise again 3 days, you know. We've got to realize and truly understand what God did for us. With sending his son. The scripture says in the book of Romans, Paul said that God gave him up for us. God gave him up. This July is going to be 4 years since our son died. And believe me, I did not give him up. If I had that choice, I would say, Stephen, get out of that, you know, get off of that ventilator and come walk out of that room right now. If I had the choice, that's what I would say. I didn't give him up. I didn't let go. Man, I was there all that night, you know, trying to be with our son the best we could. We couldn't be in the room. We just had to watch him through a window. But God, as we're going to see next week, has a choice. And what he chooses is to watch his only begotten son die in agony so that you and I can go to heaven. Boy, you talk about love. That's love, isn't it? And that's what he's done for us. So don't miss next Sunday as we take a look, a deeper look at what God, what his view is of the cross. Okay? We're going to be singing the invitation song in just a moment here. And during this invitation, once again, it's just that opportunity for us to truly take a deep look within our own hearts and souls and say, okay, what is it that I need to do? This is what Jesus Christ did for me. How does it change my life? How does it impact the way that I deal with my family? How does it impact the way that I deal with my coworkers and my neighbors? How has it changed my life? Knowing what Jesus Christ has done for me. Am I just the same? Am I different? Do I want to be different? An invitation is just an opportunity for us to ask ourselves those very questions. And the majority of us will look at that as we sing this song. We will very silently say, God, forgive me for what I've done. Forgive me for my sins. Help me become more like Jesus in my life. But there will be some here today, hopefully, prayerfully, that wants to take it a step further. Who will say, man, what I need you. I need this church to be praying for me. I need to make a public confession, or I need to stand before my brothers and sisters and say, I need help because I can't do this alone. I can't do it alone. And that's what we are here for today. We want to pray with you and help you and strengthen you today. Will you give us that opportunity as together we stand and we sing?